This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Sabri Benishore, in for David Brancaccio. There are several arenas in the workplace where racism can be perpetuated, unwittingly or not. Recruiting and hiring, for example. And despite a heightened focus on racial inequality in the workplace over the past several years, progress has been, at best, mixed. So, what steps can organizations, colleagues, managers take to help create more racially inclusive workplaces? Adia Harvey Wingfield is a professor of sociology at Washington University in St. Louis. Her new book, out today, is called Gray Areas: How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. My Marketplace colleague David Brancaccio spoke with Professor Wingfield about what it takes to create more inclusive places of work.
Thank you for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
Formal systems at work are one thing. A company draws up a job description for a post, has to abide by anti-discrimination laws. But it's your view that there are a lot of systems at play in the workplace that are not formal, but they are powerful and often problematic. You call them gray areas. What are some?
Yes, exactly. So when I talk about the gray areas at work, I'm talking about the things that are a little bit separate from the core aspects of the job that people are hired to do, and more about the social, cultural, and relational parts of work. And a lot of those are highlighted through how we learn about jobs, how we get into jobs in the first place, the types of organizational cultures we encounter at work, and the processes for advancement and moving ahead. None of those things are necessarily directly tied into what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, but they all have dynamics that can serve to perpetuate racial inequalities in the workplace.
Like just how you find out about work or how you advance may not have to do with everybody gets a performance review twice a year, may have a lot to do with some of these informal processes.
Sure, exactly. So, for example, you mentioned hiring. If we think about how people find out about jobs, we have this model, I think, that you apply and the best person for a job is chosen. But we also know from research that people are much more likely to get jobs if they are referred by someone, and that most people find jobs through those who are in their social networks or their existing connections. But we also know that connections and networks are highly racialized in the extent that they're pretty racially homogenous and they tend not to be very racially diverse. So already, Black workers are starting out at a bit of a disadvantage when they have to rely on their connections and networks, which may not be very racially diverse, in order to get access to jobs in the first place.
So a firm or a person at a firm with power listening to this, wanting to address what you just said, would be to at least become aware of these gray areas, that they do play into important decisions that shape the culture of a workplace and need to be addressed?
Yes, I think a first step is awareness. But the exciting thing, at least for me as a researcher, about this type of work is that there are also solutions and things that can be done differently. So I just mentioned the example of hiring, and that's one of many that I talk about in the book. And I give examples of ways that some of my respondents that I follow either were locked out of networks or didn't have access to networks, or knew people who didn't really vouch for them or offer connections when it came to getting hired. But there are steps that people who are at companies can take. And we know from research that one of the most obvious ones involves just broadening your social network.
And by the way, just a reminder, because it's 2023, when you say social networks, you're not just talking about an app. You're talking about going to conferences, going to campuses, meet groups of new people that normally you would not have if you have the power to help promote people or hire people.
Right, exactly. That this can't just be who's, I'm showing my age a little bit here, but it can't just be who's in your Facebook feed, right? And it can't just be your Facebook friends. It involves the relationships and the connections that people have in their everyday lives. So when we talk about social networks and connections, particularly from a social science standpoint, it's often the more distant relationships and connections that matter. But again, when we look at our networks and how they're built, we still live in pretty racially segregated communities. We often still live pretty racially segregated lives. And data has shown that for many white respondents, they don't have very racially diverse friend groups or friend networks or connections. And so that's a critical step for thinking about how the reliance on who we already know means that racial disparities end up getting perpetuated in workplaces. People have to be willing to step outside of the existing comfort zones and form concrete networks and ties and relationships with others who may not be people that they automatically gravitate to.
You and I are getting at the formal part of your own book, but I'm not getting at the heart of your book. So let me just ask you, when people endure racism at work from individuals or systems, and you emphasize this throughout the work, this doesn't just hit a person's work life or their career. It hits a person beyond where they work.
Yeah, one of the narratives that I found really affecting and moving in doing the research for this book is from a person that I call Amalia in the book. And Amalia is a journalist. And she talked with me a lot about the profound toll that being a Black woman in that field had on her. And her experience is interesting because she worked in an environment where the culture was one where they at least would acknowledge and talk about the reality of racial disparities and discrimination. And even that is pretty unusual. Many companies take the opposite tack and suggest that that's something that shouldn't be addressed, to the detriment of many Black workers. But for Amalia, being in this space where colleagues would at least acknowledge this reality, but did not necessarily address or acknowledge or seem aware of the particular toll that getting racist hate mail took on her as a Black woman, and getting barraged with this deluge of racist hate as a journalist impacted her as a Black woman, it really had some mental health consequences for her. And it was really personally affecting for me to listen to and write about how that had such an impact on the way that she lived her life, just as someone trying to do her job and do her best work.
I mean, you write that you've gotten racist emails, really hateful stuff from trolls after you've spoken out on issues, for instance, about diversity. Yet in some cases, you didn't go to your colleagues to draw them into this. You just said you didn't have the energy to walk them through what their reactions were.
Yeah, and I was a little uncertain about including that in the book initially, but as I thought about it more, it seemed to really tie to what a lot of my respondents were talking about. It also seemed to underscore a bigger point that I wanted to make about the way that these issues of race and inequality are often borne so heavily by Black workers because infrastructurally, organizations are often not set up to acknowledge, equip, deal with, or respond to these issues. So for me, when those types of things have happened, especially when I started here at WashU, I was in a new job with new coworkers, and I thought, this is just not really the start that I want to get off to. I don't want to have these conversations. I don't really know my coworkers quite that well. I'm not 100% sure of the nuances of the response that I'm going to get. And quite frankly, I don't really feel like doing the emotional management of trying to sympathize with them about something bad and upsetting that's happened to me. I'd rather just get on with my day and get back to my job. But I think for many Black workers, having to deal with that in isolation speaks to the way that organizational culture, another area that I write about in the book, just really often is not structured in a way that reflects the reality of the diverse workplaces that many organizations say that they want to create and achieve.
Yeah, you can't do it alone, right? A nurturing work environment, a welcoming, inclusive work environment has got to include people you can turn to when something happens, or at least for advice.
Right. And I found for many of my respondents in these types of spaces, I'm thinking of Constance, one of the people that I interviewed, who was a scientist and who worked in this environment where her university talked so much about diversity and said so much that it was something that mattered. But when it came to practice, they were really uncomfortable talking about racial diversity and the reality of it for scientists like Constance. They were a lot more comfortable talking about gender diversity, which translated into hiring mostly white women coworkers in her particular field. But when it came to the racial dynamics that she encountered, the isolation, the really overtly racist teaching evaluations, the being shunned and sidelined by her colleagues, there was no space for that. And again, it took a toll. It created a large sense of alienation for her. It's made it hard for her to do her job. And it just really creates a lot of difficulties for Black workers when they are going through this without organizational support.
Now, because I am such a close reader of nonfiction, like what you have produced here, I have figured out that you're not much of a fan of diversity training as it's now presented in many firms. Why not? And what's a better way?
So did that come through somewhere in the book?
Yeah, I picked it up at more than one parts per billion.
Right. Well, this is another area where, as a social scientist, we have to go back to the data, right? And the data are pretty conclusive and have been for some time that when we mandate diversity training in workplaces, it quite frankly does not work. And it doesn't work on a lot of fronts. It doesn't work for white workers because they often feel as if they're being blamed and they feel as if the company commitment is very hollow and that they're just being reminded of the things that they are doing wrong. But perhaps more surprisingly for some listeners, it also doesn't work for Black workers because they have a sense, and I think rightfully so, that these types of mandated diversity trainings are quite often just ways that companies can show that they are in compliance with legal regulations, but are not necessarily designed to address the myriad of problems that they face in their workplaces. So what I've found from my own research, what my colleagues have found, is that by and large, many workers regard diversity trainings as a waste of time. They don't learn from it in many cases. cases. They don't gain from it in many cases. And certainly the data is, as I mentioned, very conclusive that diversity trainings that are mandated do not result in an increase to the numbers of people of color and women of all races who are represented in leadership roles in organizations. That's just a fact.
But you don't want people to say, all right, let's be cynical about all efforts to fix things. What is a better way forward?
So one thing that research has shown is that instead of just mandating diversity training, when companies actually put together diversity task forces and they pull people from different levels of an organization to work together directly on this problem, they actually show more results because people in the company are more familiar with the nuances. People who are at different levels of a company are more familiar with how this issue addresses them across the board. And when people are focused on getting results and putting solutions into place, then they don't necessarily feel like they're being blamed, which is one of the big shortcomings of diversity trainings. I think it's also really important to highlight the role that diversity officers and managers play in this. When their offices are resourced, when they have support, when they have a direct line to leadership, they can really do a significant amount in helping to change some of the cultural issues that I describe in the book. But it's critical for companies not just to hire diversity officers and say, okay, this is your problem now. Companies have to really make that commitment to more diversity solidified with offering resources and providing resources to people who are in those managerial roles.
That's a key metric, right? Does the diversity officer have a direct line to management? That's what you should look for if you're trying to tell if that person has power.
Right, exactly. And some of the accounts that I show in the book are people who are in places where they weren't really able to rely on diversity managers, not because necessarily the managers didn't want to do the best that they could, but because in my view, the managers often weren't really set up to succeed by the organizations where they were being hired.
I mean, let's stipulate it's a company's problem to eradicate racism and structural racism from within their organization. But what are steps that fellow employees can take to make the workplace better? I mean, join one of those committees that you just suggested, but what are other ideas for people who are well-intentioned, earnest in their efforts to want to fix a culture?
Yes, I love this question because it points to solutions, and I think that's so important. So I think there are a few steps that track with the different stages that I talk about in the book. I focus in the book on hiring, organizational culture, and advancement. And I think for an everyday person who wants to think about what they can do in each of those areas, there are a couple of key things to keep in mind. If we're talking about hiring, I think it's critically important to go back to what I said before, to be a reference. You can develop racially inclusive networks, and you can refer Black friends and associates. When it comes to organizational culture, I think it's really critical to be an advocate. And everyday workers can speak up in support of company efforts to promote racial diversity. But maybe equally important, they can speak out when others downplay those efforts. And that can just be a simple act of saying that this work is important and trying to support what the company is doing to create more racial diversity, particularly if it's based on evidence of things that work. And joining one of those diversity task forces, like I mentioned, would be an example. And finally, when it comes to advancement, you can be a sponsor. You can seek out opportunities to empower the next generation of Black leaders. You can work with people at the company and take them under your wing and give them guidance and support. That was one of the strategies that worked for Darren, one of the people that I talk about in the book at length, who was a really high-ranking vice president at a company who told me a lot about how much mentorship and sponsorship really mattered in his opportunities to move up. And I think those are basic everyday things that people who are working in companies can do to try to see the organizations where they work change for the better.
One of my colleagues, reporter and host Kimberly Adams, did a piece that really stuck with me. It was earlier in pandemic, and she talked to people in this piece, people of color, who actually preferred working from home because they didn't have to face microaggressions at work or even microaggressions during the commute. That said, a lot of what you're talking about is harder in creating a work culture that lifts all people up, is made harder by working remotely when we don't actually see each other all that much.
Yeah. And quite honestly, that is one of the things that concerns me a bit about the shift to remote work. I don't know that we have extensive data about what it's going to mean for Black workers, but I do worry that one of the adverse outcomes of this may be that Black workers are not necessarily as able to be involved in the sort of face-to-face relationships and connections that our workplaces are built on. Now, that said, many Black workers that I've spoken to have also said something similar, that they really resonate with the opportunity to work from home because it does give them a space to be separate from and not have to interact with coworkers who may engage in microaggressions that then go unacknowledged and unresolved. But to me, what that suggests is that this puts more of the emphasis and the onus on companies, right? Because if you have a workforce where a significant number of your employees are people who need to work remotely because they're experiencing racial harassment, microaggressions, and bias in the workplace, that fundamentally is a company issue that it is incumbent upon you to resolve, particularly if you are an organization saying, as so many do, that racial diversity is important to you.
I want to ask you about a dramatic statistic in your book. You say there are more big companies run by men who have the first names of John and David than there are companies run by Black people, regardless of gender and certainly regardless of first name. What should that odd statistic tell us, Professor?
Well, it really is a jarring one, especially if we are talking about major, significant Fortune 500 companies. And it's a jarring one that indicates just how stark this leadership gap is in many ways. And one of the points that I really want to make clear is that when we think about this representation gap in leadership of companies, there are a number of answers that often get tossed about. People will say, well, it's a pipeline issue and we just can't find people who are qualified. But we also know from the data that Black workers often are as ambitious, interested, skilled, and qualified as their white counterparts. For example, there's data that I cite from a Washington Post survey that showed that for Black candidates coming out of Harvard Business School, they were less likely to end up in corporate jobs than their white counterparts. And I think it's hard to make a case that people coming out of Harvard Business School are somehow lacking business qualifications just for the obvious reasons. So the lack of qualifications is not really a factor. The lack of interest and ambition is not a factor. Other data shows that for Black women workers in particular, they are more likely to be interested in high-ranking, high-status positions than their white counterparts and women of many other races. So the interest in positions are there. The qualifications for positions are there. What we have are a sizable number of Black workers who are stalling out at middle management levels, not because they lack the skill or the interest or the motivation to move into these types of positions, but again, because organizations are often failing to recognize that skill, recognize that talent, and to work with and nurture that talent to move these ambitious Black workers into higher positions in organizations. So when we look at that statistic, I'd say the takeaway is that this is a really stark indicator of how much and how important it is for organizations to rectify these gaps and to address this clear omission in how they are nurturing and identifying talent.
And really focus on the fact that people with skills and ambition are still stalling out for all the wrong reasons.
Right. And I talk about that in the last section of the book when I focus on advancement, that there are just a number of really telling and interesting cases of people who, again, have this motivation, who have this ambition, who have the qualifications, but don't get the opportunities to move into leadership. The story I'm thinking of now is the one of Brian, who is the film director that I interviewed for the book. And he talks about sourcing these movies that are Academy Award nominated and being part of the production team on other movies that are really highly regarded and were able to make significant returns for the company where he worked, and getting these performance evaluations that say he's doing great work, but saying he still needs a little bit of improvement. And even with that, and going to ask his managers, what exactly do I need to do to improve that will line me up for a promotion? He never gets answers. He doesn't get straight responses. He gets obfuscation and stonewalling, and ultimately decides to leave because he sees that his opportunities for moving into management are continually being thwarted in that environment and that there are other places that value his talent. And I think that's a real warning sign for many leaders and companies that this type of turnover is avoidable, but it's avoidable if companies take steps, again, to identify, nurture, and support Black talent at middle levels rather than letting people get away.
Adia Harvey Wingfield is a professor at Washington University in St. Louis. Her newest book is called Gray Areas, How the Way We Work Perpetuates Racism and What We Can Do to Fix It. She's also the president-elect of the American Sociological Association. Professor, thanks for this.
Thank you. This was so fun.